Welcome to Board Game Workshop. I'm your host, Chris Anderson. This episode is part of a five-part series with Jeff Warrender discussing topics in his new book, You Said This Would Be Fun. The book is available in paperback, Kindle, and EPUB versions on Amazon and DriveThruRPG. Go to the show notes for this episode at theboardgameworkshop.com for links. The Board Game Workshop Design Contest is currently accepting submissions and judges. Submissions are due by June 5th. Go to theboardgameworkshop.com for details. That's all. Now on to the show.
In our previous two episodes exploring You Said This Would Be Fun, a new book about tabletop game design, we talked about ways that we can engage and motivate our players. We want to draw them in by making them part of an exciting story and motivate them to want to play well by giving them an interesting goal to pursue. In this episode, we'll talk about the third pillar of player-centered design, challenge. A good premise and a good goal are important, but players will rightly expect to have to surmount some obstacles in pursuit of that goal. Think for a moment about the role that an obstacle plays in a story. Say that we read a story whose plot goes like this. He had a dream of becoming a banker, and then he became a banker, and he was the best banker to have ever banked. That story delivered a happy ending, but as a story, it was terrible. There was no tension, no suspense, because there were no obstacles in our protagonist's path. We take it as an axiom of a good story that a character must overcome some obstacle of some sort, and we can take this as a guiding principle of game design as well. Our players will not thank us for giving them a card that says, play this and you win. Winning is nice, but victory must feel earned to be satisfying, and presenting a challenge is imperative as they pursue victory. And we talked in the previous episode about the role that interplayer friction presents in creating an interesting obstacle to victory, and that's certainly true. In this episode, we'll talk about the context in which that friction arises. Challenges usually come in the form of requiring our players to exercise some skill. So sports test all kinds of skills, kicking a ball, running, striking a small ball accurately with a pool cue, and so on. And tabletop games can also test a variety of skills that can include our creativity, our quick-wittedness, our ability to draw, our ability to convert anagrams to words, and many more. But for the purposes of this brief talk, we're going to limit our attention to the skill associated with the German family games school of the 90s and early 2000s, and that skill is making agonizing decisions. Now here we want to distinguish between decisions that are agonizing and decisions that are sometimes called crunchy decisions. Crunchy decisions are hard decisions. They require analysis and perhaps some computation. In a crunchy decision, maybe I'm given a hand of 10 cards and told to combine them however I wish, but to see how many points I can make out of that hand. And so maybe I think about this for a few minutes, and then emerge from deep thought and declare, aha, I can make 8 points. But when I play a game like that, I can't ever escape the feeling that just over my shoulder lurks the wise master who looks at my 8 points and says, well done, pupil, you are on the right path, but actually you could have made a 15-point play if you had just thought about it more. Now, of course, there isn't really the wise master over our shoulder providing feedback on our play, and that's actually just the point. Not only do I have to think about whether I've come up with the best answer, I never really know for sure until I've gained a lot of experience with the game. But that experience isn't agonizing, it's frustrating, and moreover, the familiarity with the game that will reduce these feelings of frustration ends up being highly specific to that game. It's not necessarily portable. So once I understand this particular game's puzzle, I can solve it effectively every time I play the game, but that's of little use to me when I'm playing other games. In contrast, the skills you cultivate in playing a game with agonizing decisions can be implemented in other games because ultimately they entail things like being wise, judicious, disciplined, aggressive, charming, whatever the game's mechanics and your reading of the room call for. An agonizing decision, then, is one in which I have a couple of choices, not 10, not 15, a couple, and they're all good choices, but they also have downsides. It isn't just lobster or steak, there are pros and cons to each available choice. And as we said, it isn't just left hand or right hand. That's a guess, and an agonizing decision isn't a guess. You know you're making an agonizing decision when you experience a state of tension in the literal sense. The decision gives you the feeling of being pulled in two different directions. And it also creates tension in the narrative sense, because as our axiom stated, you know what the short-term outcome of your decision will be, but you don't know the ramifications of that decision because they're not entirely within your control. You decide, and then the opponents get to have their say as they react to what you've done, and then you react to their play, and so on. The tension this generates creates the interplayer friction that we previously discussed, and it also supports the growing suspense that drives the game toward an exciting conclusion. Agonizing decisions, then, are closely associated with open and richly interactive games, and correspondingly, these opponent reactions provide the feedback to our decisions that the imaginary wise master could not, in part because he or she was imaginary. In an open play game, we don't speak of decisions having been right or wrong. We simply speak of whether they were effective or not, whether they were successful or unsuccessful. And we can interpret the effectiveness of our decisions based on what the other players did in response. If my attempt to take the castle failed because you sprung a trap that you had set for me, then the attack was unsuccessful, but was it wrong? Not at all. Its rightness or wrongness aren't something you could have calculated in advance. They're determined by the reaction that you made in response to my attempt. Now, of course, it's true I might have been wise to take into account the possibility of you springing a trap on me when I chose that course, but the main point remains that we think about success or failure, not right or wrong. For the remainder of this episode, I want to talk about one particularly important aspect of agonizing decisions: opportunity cost. I wouldn't say that most game designers tend to overlook or ignore opportunity cost considerations in their designs, but I do think it's not inaccurate to say it's not always something we're consciously aware of and thinking about. Opportunity cost is, in a sense, the road not taken. If I pay 3 gold to buy 2 lumber, then those 3 gold are the direct cost of the lumber. But the opportunity cost is whatever I did not buy with that gold but could have. And since in most games we're afforded only a limited number of chances to interact with the game state, there's also the opportunity cost of the turn itself. A turn spent building is a turn not spent conquering or promoting culture or instituting reforms or whatever. Most games have a single and central source of tension, like Diamant with its in-or-out doublethink, and Chinatown with how hard to push for the best deal. But opportunity cost considerations are different, in that in a good game, nearly all of these considerations we're going to look at should probably make an appearance. First is tempo. This has a chronological sound to it, and it means the pace at which I'm playing, the energy state I'm trying to achieve. As an opportunity cost, tempo means that I'm giving up something that might help me out long term to gain something that propels me forward in the near term, or it means that I do the opposite of that. I slow down to build for the future. Consider as a simple example a mechanic where maybe I can either build 2 units or I can build 1 unit and then move it. In the latter case, I gave up some long-term board power, but in exchange, I gained some operational tempo. A second form of opportunity cost is interference. As we've discussed, there are many games in which we each do our own thing and then emerge to compare how we did at the end, but in a heavily interactive game, letting the other players each do their own thing can prove fatal. But at the same time, the tension arises from the fact that usually I would prefer to continue building up my own position as opposed to interfering with yours. Different games handle this differently, but to me, the best implementation of these considerations is Puerto Rico, where the role that I select on my turn should ideally be the one that helps me the most and also helps my opponents the least. And in practice, I will pick the one that's the best compromise between those. On the other hand, the worst implementation of interference consideration are games like this. Susie is next to go after you, and if you don't attack her, she will win. So it falls to you to give up your turn and attack Susie. Like all things, these principles can be realized well or they can be realized poorly, but we should strive to realize them well if we can. A third concept of opportunity is flexibility. Sometimes I'll give up something to gain something that's more versatile, or I'll relinquish some flexibility to gain something that's more tangible. Sometimes it's as simple as, we strike a deal, but you don't have anything that I want right now, so I will give you what you want from me in exchange for future consideration. Flexibility is akin to the financial concept of liquidity. Having money in the bank, I'm very liquid. I can do lots of different things with that money. but my money might be more powerful if I invest it in a mutual fund or buy some property with it. I become less liquid in doing so because it's not as easy to get my money out should I need it. But sometimes relinquishing that liquidity in the short term can lead to gains in the long term. And this same kind of thinking animates opportunity cost considerations. And then fourth and finally, there's the famous window of opportunity. Something is only available for a limited time, perhaps because the game is going to take it away or because the other players might pounce on it before I get the chance. A great embodiment of this is the draft row of Vinci, which later became Small World. In that mechanic, there's a row of civilizations which are increasingly costly to select, going from left to right. And when you select your civilization, any civs to the left of the one you chose become less expensive for the next person. And if they're passed over enough times, they may even pay positive costs to you once they're selected. This should probably sound familiar because it's been emulated many times, and it's a great way to force you into window of opportunity agony. Can I wait to take this thing that's available now? Will it still be there? And perhaps if I wait, maybe it'll even be less expensive. Or conversely, if I wait too long, maybe it will become more expensive. The aforementioned wheeling and dealing games like Chinatown present a dynamic window of opportunity landscape because the offer that you're making me is only good until you get a better offer from someone else. So I have to try to talk you down in price, but I also have to know when it's best to settle for an imperfect deal to avoid being left out in the cold entirely. Opportunity cost is a fitting topic on which to end our exploration of engagement, motivation, and challenge. We've engaged our players with an exciting story, with a concrete role and a concrete goal in that story. And opportunity cost considerations, where I choose this at the expense of missing out on that, are familiar problems that characters and stories face. And if we've chosen a good source of tension, this agonizing decision will map well onto the kind of problem a character in our role would experience. Then we've motivated our players with a fun contest that rewards them for grappling with their opponents and the friction that those interactions create. Opportunity cost problems of tempo, interference, flexibility, and windows are all relative problems. We want to gain as much opportunity as we can relative to our opponents, and we want to deprive them of as much opportunity as we can. Finally, we've challenged our players with agonizing decisions, rich with uncertain outcomes that respond and evolve in response to the players' decisions. A deep game has room to allow players to develop heuristics, but a lively and interactive game always requires those heuristics to adapt to the unfolding game situation. An opportunity cost that change as we go will surely keep players on their toes. So we've established a solid foundation on which to build good games, and in the next and final episode, we'll talk about the practical process by which these good games come about, namely through a rigorous process of playtesting.
That's all for this episode. Financial support for the Board Game Workshop is provided by our annual game design contest and our Patreon supporters. Special thanks to our inventor-level supporters, Corey Muddiman, Roscoe Schock, Brad Batchelor, and Chris Turner. If you would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/theboardgameworkshop. You can contact the show on Twitter, Facebook, and Discord. Go to theboardgameworkshop.com for links, past episodes, and information about our design contest and other events. Thanks for listening!